Okay, so it's going to be a little shorter today. I just want to give you a overview and a little walkthrough of NVIDIA's GPU architecture. Okay, so as we had with Intel and now with and with AMD, we have approximately the same thing for NVIDIA's history of chips they made and microarchitectures. So NVIDIA's first GPU came out in 1995. Okay, so quite a long time ago, I guess.
Depends.
Depends.
What you say, how it's long or how it's not long?
Well, if you consider the advancements that have been made in the last 11 years, it's quite a long time, I guess. Yeah, 20 years is.
I was alive.
Who wasn't, right?
Then.
Anyways, it was one of the first GPUs. And from 1995 to 2006, it's not like nothing happened there. It's just that they produced lots of GPUs, but they didn't have any microarchitecture name or anything. They were really just GPUs, okay? And back in the day, what came up in the early 2000 was a thing called fixed function pipeline, right? Where you could program separate parts of your GPU, right? Like if you remember or not, from the last lecture, we had the shader programs, right? And fixed function pipeline means that you either have a fixed function, so you can dispatch your geometries, your pixels, etc., which is then being worked on by the GPU, right? And eventually the shaders came into play, right? Where you could program separate stages of your shaders, right? Pixel shader, geometry shader, vertex shader, which was the beginning of programmable GPUs, right? And in 2006, the GeForce 7000 series was the last GPU which had a fixed function pipeline architecture. Okay. In 2007, the first fully to some extent programmable GPU was released. Right. It was the microarchitecture code name was Tesla. Okay. And it was also, since it was the first fully programmable microarchitecture, it was also the first CUDA GPU. Okay, so CUDA is the programming API for NVIDIA GPUs. Okay.
But there was another name. You say, you know, the last time you said that there was, so because CUDA is like a programming language, or is like the assembler of it?
CUDA is the programming language that we in scientific computing and high performance computing care about.
High
Okay,
performance
so
language.
no, yes, to some extent, it's a general purpose programming language. Okay, so general purpose in terms of GPU architecture.
But
Okay, what I mentioned last time was the shader languages. Okay, and the shading languages are a domain specific language, and the domain which they cover is graphics programming. Okay, so there's CUDA, there's OpenCL, there's SQL, there is Direct Compute. With Vulkan, you can program GPUs as well. So there are a few APIs that you can program GPUs with. Okay, but for supercomputers, the most prevalent API there is to use is CUDA. Okay, because there is no supercomputer with any other GPU than NVIDIA. Okay, so that's why we'll focus on CUDA for the time being. Okay, and in 2010 they increased the they increased the double precision performance, and they included caches, right? And then they continuously improved their microarchitectures, and now we arrived at the Turing microarchitecture, which added ray tracing. The Volta architecture added the tensor cores, and the Pascal architecture added the high bandwidth memory. Okay, so that's the rough history of NVIDIA GPUs. Okay, just so you have a small timeline of what we're speaking of, and the second largest supercomputer in Europe has Pascal cards, Pascal chips in them. It's the Piet Stein supercomputer from the Swiss Supercomputing Center. It's located in Lugano, in the southern part of Switzerland. And the current number one system has Volta GPUs in them.
Which is the one?
Summit, it's called Summit, yes.
Where is it located?
It's located in Oak Ridge National Laboratory. That's in the United States, in Tennessee. Okay. No. Okay. Right. So before I give you the CUDA introduction, I want to walk you through the Volta architecture and how it looks like. So now you have to remember what we talked about last time. So you will see lots of concepts that we heard last time. Now in the Volta architecture, okay? And you will hopefully recognize most of the parts there, okay? So here's the big picture, the big schematics for a Volta, for a complete Volta chip, okay? And on such a Volta chip, we have 80 streaming multiprocessors and a total of 5,120 CUDA cores, right? Which is quite a lot. For each streaming multiprocessor, we have two tensor cores. Okay, so right, so they are expressed here, right? And a full full Volta 100 chip contains 84 SMs, right? So. Just for reference. So we have a fairly large last level cache, and we will see that each of the SMs have separate caches as well. We have at the corner, at the borders, we have the memory controllers, right? And here at the bottom, which you can't read, is the interconnect to other peripherals, which they called NVLink. Okay, so the GPU performance, of course. So I forgot to mention, this is a slide from an NVIDIA engineer, and of course they try to sell their product. So they always have something like, "We have increased the GPU performance," right? And this is more or less what you see here, right? So they were able to improve the performance of the deep learning algorithm, so deep learning training and deep learning inferencing, right? And that's mainly due to the tensor cores that they added, okay, which we will talk about later. Then you have double precision and single precision performance of a chip, right? Which they increased by a factor of 1.5. And the total bandwidth to the main memory that's on the GPU is now 900 gigabytes per second. Right? If you compare that to your regular Xeon CPU, you have about 60 gigabytes per second. So that's quite a lot, right? This is what the high throughput means, right? Lots of bandwidth, high throughput. For the off-chip communication, so with other GPUs, for example, or with some CPUs, you get 300 gigabytes per second, and you have a fairly large level 2 and level 1 cache. Right. So let's look into this NVLink. The NVLink is something to talk to other GPUs and to other and to the CPU. So the main goal from a high level perspective of NVLink is to increase the programmability of the GPUs, and the biggest improvement there is that we gain a flat address space. That means that we can directly access the memory on the device from our CPU. Okay. And yeah, so we can directly use the GPU uses the page table, so the translation of the different memory regions of the CPU, right? So that's very nice. Okay. And of course, improved atomics. Okay. The bandwidth is pretty nice, right? With 300 gigabytes per second. And what you can do with it is something like that, right? So there is one product from NVIDIA. It's called DGX-1, which is a platform for machine learning. And it's one single box. And they put eight Volta GPUs in there. Okay, eight Volta GPUs and two Xeon CPUs. Okay, and the Volta GPUs are interconnected with each other via the NVLink interfaces. Okay, so you have six NVLink channels, right? And two of them go to the neighboring GPUs, right? And you essentially form a something like a cube mesh with the NVLink connectors, right? The Summit supercomputer, as I mentioned, is also equipped with Volta GPUs. We will discuss the Summit design and Summit architecture in more detail later on, but just for the sake of completeness, they have the Power9 CPUs in them, and Power9 directly supports NVLink. Intel doesn't. That's why the NVLink is able to directly talk to the CPU, right? So it's directly connected to the CPU. And you have three Volta chips per CPU, which is quite intense, right? Okay. And the goal, of course, is that you have increased bandwidth to communicate from one GPU to the other, and towards the CPU as well, right? So what we will also learn is a supercomputer doesn't only consist of one of those nodes, right? But they consist of more, and they therefore also have a network in them. So in order to transfer memory from the GPU memory from one node to another node's GPU memory, you always kind of have to go through the CPU, not necessarily, but at least to dispatch the work, the DMA transfer to the network. Okay, so that's why you also need a fast connection to the CPUs. Okay, so one SM core looks a little bit like this. So each SM core has four subcores, okay, which they can drive independently. And each of those cores, it's a little bit hard to see. Let me try to zoom in. Okay. I guess that's a little bit better. Okay. So each subcore is its own streaming multiprocessor, so to say, and they have two tensor cores, okay, and sixteen integer ALUs and 16 single precision and 8 double precision ALUs, right? They also have a few load and store execution units and one special function unit. The special function unit is usually to to do special math functions like exponential functions, sine functions, cosine functions, and things like that. Okay. So.
But they have stored these functions in the special function unit, or you have to program.
If you so, there are special instructions which go to the special function unit, right? So if you remember, when you so you don't directly talk to those to the execution units, you write a instruction, right? And then the dispatch unit actually dispatches it to the corresponding execution unit, right? So the instruction gets decoded, and then the hardware figures out where the stuff should be executed on. Okay.
So that's right. So there are say, some functions that are storing so the dispatcher will know that have to put it in the dispatcher.
Yeah, because it's a special instruction. No. And clear? Yeah. And this register file here is to hold the execution context we talked about, right? Okay. So when I'm stupid. Why doesn't it go to that now? So when we look at this streaming multiprocessor, so here are again the subcores, right? And we have the level one instruction cache where the subcores get their data, get their instructions from, right? And each are connected to the data cache as well. Okay. So the interesting thing here is that each of those subcores has their own dispatcher, their own instruction decoding and scheduling logic to schedule the different instructions. Right. So. Here's a more detailed picture, right, where we have the level one, the instruction cache, which can deliver four instructions, four warp instructions per cycle, right, and then each of the subcores gets one of those instructions, can execute one warp instruction per cycle, and can directly talk to the level one cache, right, and here's an even more detailed picture of one of the subcores, right, where we get the instructions. So we have one warp instruction per cycle where we dispatch the instruction to the specific execution units, right? So this is the SIMD part of the architecture then. So even though you only have a scalar instruction, since we have this warp programming model, we are able to, the hardware is able to automatically spread out the instruction to the specific execution units, right? So, yeah, if we have a load store operation, it will go to the memory I/O queue, right? Which means that the instruction will be held for later scheduling, which directly relates to the to the stalling, right? When we have a memory load or memory store instruction, we go to that queue, then this instruction stream, this execution context is being held, and once the memory operation has been completed, it's being fed back into the scheduler, it's being reactivated again, right? So in this register file, we can hold 512 registers for 32 threads at 32 bits, right? So this is quite a lot, right? Which is very nice to overlap the memory latencies that we have for our architecture. Okay. So again, the level one data cache is also designed in such a way that it can perfectly drive the different subcores. So we have four channels to the subcores, and each of those channels is able to deliver 64 bytes per cycle. Right? And from the level two cache, we are able to get 128 bytes per cycle. Okay. which is quite nice. So this means that we have four times the bandwidth of the previous architectures, because they have to accommodate for the increased execution units, right? You always have to have this balance between getting data and executing faster. Right? The other nice thing is that you can split this cache so that you can either have the transparent caching or shared memory, right? So shared memory means that you essentially are able to write your own caching, right? You can use this shared memory block here, 128 kilobytes, to optimize your application and to preload data and to have the data available once you need it, right? Which is pretty nice. And this is how it looks like, right? So when we make use of this additional shared memory, we get a fairly good performance improvement, right? So if we use the shared space instead of the caches, we get faster atomics. It's obviously more predictable since we know what's going on, since we program it. But the caches are obviously easier to use, right? Because we don't have to think about what data do we need next, etc. Right? And it's most of the time 90% as good as doing the if we would program it directly. Okay. So another nice thing is that we got independent thread scheduling. Okay, so if you remember what we talked about last time with that we have one instruction stream per warp, right? They changed that in the Volta architecture such that each thread in a warp has actually its own program counter. Okay, the effect is that
one thing to return to that, to the previous one, in the part of the caches. So in one part. So it's better to use then the shared cache than the normal.
Well, if you want to put the extra effort in, right, to think about your data movement and what data you need, then you can get a 10% performance improvement. If you have an application that's utilizing the caches, that's cache aware, etc., then you lose approximately 10% of performance in contrast to what you could do when you only have shared memory. So when you explicitly load the data in shared memory, into the shared memory.
Right, shared memory will be better then.
Shared memory is better because it's more predictable, right? The caching hardware always have to make some guesses, right? And you have this replacement strategies, and so on, right? So you have replacement strategies, you have the different associativity levels, the different sets, etc. So it might happen that you evict data that you might need in the next in the near future, right? But if you only use the shared memory stuff, so if you make use of the shared memory of the GPU, so it's a local scratchpad memory, which is very fast, right? So you get theoretically better performance because you don't have to rely on this on the caching algorithm that has been implemented, and you can directly read and write and evict data for your application's need. Okay. No.
But the thing is, normally when you program, you use a normal cache because you're doing cracking or doing your own algorithm for caches, not so easy to do, imagine, huh? It's not so common. It's not so common that people use the shared memory.
On CPUs, we don't have the ability to have something like a shared memory, right? We only have the level one cache.
Okay.
And what we do when we program CPUs, we try to program it in such a way that it's cache aware, that we exploit the temporal and spatial localities of our algorithms,
okay,
right, in order to improve the performance, in order to get the data faster to the CPUs. Okay, in architectures like GPUs or almost any other accelerator, you have those shared memory spaces, right, which are for the NVIDIA GPUs, they are shared among the warps, okay, and they can be used as a local scratch pad, okay. So if you write, so one other difference, if you write something to shared memory, right, you write it to shared memory only. If you write it to the caches, well, yeah, they might
take more time.
Not more time, but the data might also be propagated to main memory already, which might not be needed anyways, right? So you just are able to place the data that you need into shared memory, okay, and then work on the shared memory. So if you think about your the stencil example in your assignments, right? You could, for example, place so you schedule a warp, right? And you fill so you have a warp, and you fill all of your shared memory with the data with the two input vectors, right? Mm-hmm. So that means that you can directly and very fast access this the vector, right? And then you can just process the stuff that's in your shared memory. You don't have to deal with the memory latencies to main memory while processing it. You are very fast, and at the end, once you finish the processing, you can store the output array that you also have in shared memory in one chunk, more or less, to main memory, right? So you just process faster. Okay, so just as an example. Okay. So independent thread scheduling, right? So when we look at regular or the usual SIMD instructions, right? We explicitly have to take care that convergence is happening, right? So that we eliminate the branches in order to make use of the vector registers, right? If we only need to process one or two or three of those elements, well, yeah, we have to do something special, right? On GPUs, I can just write my if statements, and the execution units, the dispatcher and the scheduler on the GPU hardware automatically takes care that only those registers which are implicitly masked with the branch instructions are executed, right? And that's why the convergence of the instruction stream on inner warp is a optimization for the GPU programming model, right? An important optimization, nevertheless, but it's still an optimization. Okay, and what you have with Volta is that now you're able to have multiple program counters per warp, right? Which means that the convergence is still an optimization, but it's already done in hardware. Okay, it's still hurting to some extent in terms of performance, but it's way better. And the other advantage is that the different threads in a warp can now guarantee forward progress. Okay, so previous to Volta, you were not able to implement something like a spin lock on a GPU, right? Because the spin lock would just spin forever, and there would be no guarantee that the warp that's executing the spin lock is actually the thread that's trying to acquire the spin lock. There's no guarantee that the other thread that needs to release the spin lock is actually able to run, because they might be scheduled on the same warp, and then depending on which thread gets scheduled first, we essentially create a deadlock. And with this independent program counters, you can now implement something like a spin lock, right? Great. So essentially, they increase the threat level parallelism, right?
With the previous Wayne. So they scale the threats by doing the previous
the previous thing you explained is how they manage to do more threats. Scalar the array threat? No.
No. They are able to, so they were able to break this or to weaken this this SIMD style execution of the threats. Okay, that's what I was saying. And the big advantage is if you have this array of scalar threats, which is a war, right? You can use a scalar compiler, which is which we have 50 plus years of history of for optimizations, right? So we can expect that this scalar compiler for the scalar control flow is very good, right? And we have the scalar instruction set architecture, which the NVIDIA GPUs had since the beginning, right? It's what we talked the last time. And then you have this thread virtualization technique, right? Which is we have the scalar instruction stream, right? And then more or less broadcasted to our execution units, right? Thread virtualization. And by having the different program counters, we are able to increase the instruction level parallelism once we deal with branches or something like that. Right? And with the SIMD units, right? If we go back, so here we have the different ALUs for the different data types, right? And they are executed in a SIMD fashion, nevertheless.
They are executing us?
In a SIMD fashion, single instruction, multiple data.
Okay, yes.
Right? And this is when this is where the efficiency then comes in, right? Okay. Right. Okay. So, yeah. You can also do warp synchronization in such a way that so the different colors mean that you execute a different instruction on each of those warp threads, right? And so this just means that you can execute different instructions and essentially eventually you converge again, right? It's just an optimization in the architecture. So here's the other example for GPU thread synchronization. And now let's go to the tensor cores, okay? So the tensor cores are a unit which are able to do a matrix-matrix multiplication and an addition, okay? The caveat here is that the matrix-matrix multiplication is only done in half precision floating point, okay? So in scientific computing, you usually use double precision floating points. So we have not only half of the precision, but only fourth of the precision that we would need in the regular applications for simulating stuff, okay? So its main use is for machine learning, as mentioned, right? And you can, it's still a big advancement, right? It's still a very nice addition to the hardware. And there are, there is research in how to improve the algorithms, the numerical algorithms that we have to also work with half precision floating point, right? At least some parts of the algorithm. So if you think, for example, a Yeah, iterative solver, like the Gauss-Seidel solver or a multigrid method, right, which eventually converge to a given solution, they might even work with half precision. But that's open research still. Okay?
Sorry, why we can't use for A, B double precision? Because of
Because it's
complexity?
not implemented. No. I mean, it's
Why?
this half precision,
Yeah, okay.
right? This means that we only have 2 bytes. Is it 2 bytes? 4 bytes? 2 bytes. So 2 bytes is half precision, 4 bytes is single precision, and 8 bytes is double precision, right? That means that the range of numbers that we can store isn't as high, right? And so we can't represent as much numbers with the half precision. That also means that since we have
You cannot.
we cannot know. And the reason, so if we have smaller data paths, right, so only 2 bytes here, right, that means that we need less space to actually implement the arithmetic operations on the chip, right?
But the thing is that I don't see is why they see it like an advantage. So why they see like an advantage that okay, we're using in our matrix, we're using half a precision instead of full precision.
Yeah. So the reason is that for machine learning, you don't need single or double precision because everything's very blurry there anyways, right? So you don't need the full precision there in order to do the machine learning stuff.
Because there are more integer numbers instead of floating point numbers, you see.
No, they still work on floating point numbers, but the I mean, machine learning is just statistics in to some extent,
Yeah.
okay? And when you run something through a neural network, the output that you get are some weights, right? For some of the features, okay? And here it doesn't really matter if it's half full or half single or double precision. It's just not needed for this specific application, right? So that's why they went with single precision. It's cheaper for them to produce, takes up less space, but the application can benefit from it. Okay, and yeah, deep learning and machine learning is everywhere, right? So everyone needs it. So they saw a market opportunity.
And the thing, the advantage is that you can have a multiplication of half precision,
No.
and then you can sum it up with
With a single instruction.
in a single instruction you can
In a
multiply.
single instruction. So this operation is a single instruction.
So that, but that's why in the part of summing, you can sum it with a double, with a no double, a precision, a one precision, single precision variable. So that's the okay. So that's the
No.
advantage. Doing all this in one
In one cycle.
cycle. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So
Nice.
it's one instruction, one cycle, right? And if you go back to here, right, you actually have two tensor cores, right? So you can do two tensor operations per SM, right? And you have 80 SMs, so you have 640 tensor operations, and that's where this speed up
Comes up.
comes into play, right? Okay. So yeah, you have your warps, and then you can so not so okay. You only have two tensor operations, right, in your warp. Right. But each warp, of course, can dispatch a tensor operation, right? But if we have 32 warp threads, right, that means that we can. So if each of the 32 warp threads execute a dispatches a instruction for this tensor core operation, right, that means that they are done in 16 cycles, right? because you can't, so you only have two of them available, but it's still faster than doing it by hand, right? or writing it explicitly, right?
So because of the numbers of elements that you have in the matrix, huh?
Because of the number of elements, yeah.
You can use only two.
Yeah. So the a matrix multiplication is has the algorithmic complexity roughly of n to the power of 3, mm-hmm. Okay, because you need 3 loops,
okay.
Right? And then you have the addition, so n in the number of elements, so this would be 16 to the power of 3, 16 to the power of 3 operations, and additionally another 16, right? So that's quite a few, right? So you need quite a few cycles. Instead, you could just do the same operation in one cycle.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So, okay, and yeah, they claim that the relative performance, so with the in comparison to the previous chip, the Pascal chips, right, you get approximately 10x improvements there, which is quite nice. So for a matrix multiplication with 2,000 elements per, 2,000 by 2,000 elements, right? So we have but still only half precision, but that's still something.
Yeah, they you don't need more, so. Yeah. No, that's what they suggest.
No. Okay, so that's essentially the gist of it, right? So the biggest improvements are that we have a improvement in the programmability of the chip, since we have the independent thread scheduling, the unified memory, etc. Right? We have the improved bandwidth and the new streaming multiprocessor has also increased the performance, and the tensor cores are quite excellent for the deep learning algorithm. So on the Summit supercomputer, for example, there was a deep learning application was running on the whole of the Summit computer, right? And it achieved actually 1 exaflop in performance. Only half precision, but still something, right? Okay, that's the quick run through of the Tesla V100 chip. Okay, so if you compare it to what we discussed previously, in terms of the GPU programming model and the GPU architecture, I hope that a lot of things now make sense when looking at the GPU architectures. Okay. And now let's look at how the CUDA programming actually looks like. Okay, so CUDA claims that it's that it provides a unified programming model. Okay, and this means that a CUDA program is more or less an extension of a C++ program. Okay, so extension means that they added a few extra stuff to support the GPU offloading. Okay, so the CUDA kernels are offloaded to the GPU, and for that they introduced function modifiers. So host, device, and global. Okay. Host means that the function is only supposed to be executed on the CPU. Device means that the function is for the GPU device, and global is the entry point to run a program on the GPU. Okay. In addition to that, we have 4 types of memory. Right. Normal. So that means that it's wherever that the current stream of execution is. device, which means it's always on the device, shared, that means we place it in shared memory, and const, which is then in the const memory. Okay. So if we go back to if we go back to those slides, if we So here you have extra memory for the constant stuff that you can declare. So that's even faster. It's limited in space, but it's still there.
And in the architecture we can see. In the architecture we can see that memory.
That's here. So no, there's a separate
But is the architecture the cores and not that memory is not shown?
No. It's only when you look closer. So it's not in there. It's not in the high level picture.
But that's why it should be in that part.
Write an email to NVIDIA. Okay. So in order to get stuff on the CPU on the GPU, so when we write a program, we always start at the CPU, okay? And in order to get our data to the GPU, we need we used to need some special memory management API, okay? So that means we need to we have special functions to allocate memory on the device, and we have a function to copy memory to the device and from the device and from the device to another device. Okay, with the Volta chip and NVLink, we now have the ability to use the flat memory address space. Right, so we don't necessarily need the CUDA memcopy stuff anymore. Right, CUDA malloc is still very useful, but CUDA memcopy, yeah, it depends. Okay, so the different types of memory are, well, of course, we have the registers, right, which are in the register file. We have the local memory, which is, I think, the name is very misleading because it's actually not local in terms of physical location. It's actually located in the main memory of the GPU, right? The reason why it's called local is because it's something like the stack on a CPU. Right, so it's the space, it's the memory that's being used to pass parameters, to deal with register spills, for example, if you don't have enough registers and you need to temporarily store it to main memory. But it also means that it's very slow, and it's just and local means that it's just visible to the current thread. Right, then we have the shared memory, which we discussed already, right? It's visible within a block. It's directly located on the chip with the Volta architecture at the same location where the level one cache is. Then we have the global const and texture memory, right? We saw already that the const memory has its special region on the chip. It still needs to transfer the data from main memory to some extent, but the key point here is that those three types of, well, kind of global memory all have different data paths, right? So that means that you can maximize your bandwidth utilization by making use of those different kinds of memory, right? The thing is that the access in the kernels for const and texture is only read-only, right? So you can only set the memory from your CPU code, right? So let's see how this looks like, right? So this is a very, very simple example, right? So we write our function here, right? And this is our kernel function. This is the entry point for the GPU program. Right, that's why we have the global here, right? And then we just write our regular C++ code or C code, right? And the interesting thing here is that we have those block index and thread index, right? This means that those are provided by the those are intrinsic variables provided by the CUDA implementation, and the thread index means the thread in our warp. Okay, we can use thread indices to up to three dimensions. Right, so we can adapt the layout and the logical structure of our threads for our application. The block is similar as well, and the block then unifies the different warps that we have for our program, right? And the way you launch this kernel is by using those three angle brackets here. Specify your grid dimension and your block dimension and the stream that you want to dispatch this function to, this kernel call to. At the end, you want to synchronize with your device, right? Such that you know that the computation is finished. Okay.
Where you're calling the function kernel?
Here.
Okay.
Okay.
And the thing is that if this is redundant question, I know, but so the threads understand. So the threads understand. But what is how the block? So how do you work with the blocks part?
Okay. Let's run this. Okay. So. Let's see. So now everyone can see, right? So let's connect to the EMI cluster. So everyone should have access to EMI now, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So give me a second, I need to swap. So I'm now, okay, that's not working. Right, so what I do now is I give me a session. I want to have a, I want to allocate a one node and use one graphics card, right? So this is the syntax how you do it. So this means interactive session, right? And now it will take a little while until I get the allocation. Okay. The syntax how this looks like is actually described at the EMI documentation. So if you
ever K20M is like give me for 20 minutes, huh?
No. So if we go to the EMI documentation, right, we get a documentation on how to use the system, right? So what we are interested in is the batch processing. We have the different queues. I will skip lots of them, right? And there's also the way on how to specify which nodes you want, right? So first of all, so this is something you always want, right? And here you specify the number of nodes, right? And here you specify the processes per node, right? So you always want to have something like one or two or three or whatever, right? And I can add additional properties, right, to this command, to this qsub command, and I can look up which properties are available, right? And I see that I have different kinds of memory, right? I can use one GPU. I can use nodes with one GPU. I can use nodes with two GPUs. I can use nodes with Xeon Phis, right? So that's how I get the different node configurations. And I just specified that I want one node with a GPU in there, right? So K20M is one or two NVIDIA Kepler cards. Okay.
Kepler is from which year?
Kepler is from 2008, I believe, or nine.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite old, but it's it'll work for you guys. it's perfectly sufficient for the exercises. Okay. So let's. So now I'm on the. Now I'm on one of those notes, right? And I can see that I have one, or I'm even on a node with two Tesla cards in there, right? So that's pretty nice. So I have my CUDA example, right? Which is more or less the same that I had on the slides, right? I can compile it with the NVIDIA compiler, NVCC, that's available once I loaded the CUDA module. Okay. I then just tell it which file to compile and the output. Okay? Oh, come on.
Extension of the file is CU, yes?
Excuse me?
It's not CPP like in C++, it's CU.
Yeah, it's CU for CUDA.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, come on. Okay. So. All right. Eventually, I was able to compile it. Okay. And now I can run it. Right. And I see that it ran for the different it ran the kernel for exactly what I specified, right? Oh shit. Okay, so it's not executing linearly, it's executing in some arbitrary order, right? Okay. And yeah, there a question?
No, just saying. Yeah.
So, if I okay, so blocks just tells me how many warps I want to schedule. Okay, so if I in the block, I change it to say I want to execute 2,500 threads in a warp. Right, I can compile it and then run it, right, and it will just die, so no output anymore, right? So what happened is that 50 by 50, so 2,500 is just too much, right,
for the
warp. I can only have 32 per warp, right? So my block, the extent of the block can only be 32, right? So the first times second times third needs to be less or equal than 32, right? Otherwise it's too much. So if I do it like this, then it should work. So this means that I want to have 32 threads in my warp, right? So, right? Perfect. It executed my 32 threads. Right? If I say I want 33, then it will... oh, still works. But it only works, so it never outputs 32, right? Oh, here it's 32. Right, I can have 512 per block even. Yeah, can have 512 per block. Oh, sorry. Hey. Where is my? Ah, yeah. So if I have five, it's still working. Mystery.
Maybe because we have two. So we have two GPU
No, this is only running on one GPU. If I need to run on more than one GPU, I have to explicitly program it. So now I really wonder where the limit is. You probably can also read it in the documentation. So now it's not working anymore. So the limit seems to be 1024, okay? Because I have the different thread contexts, right? So I still have 32 threads per warp, right? But per SM, I have my 32 execution contexts, theoretically, right? So, 32 per 32 is, of course, 1024.
And in each core, I have 32.
No, I have 32. I can execute 32 warps per 32 threads per warp, okay, and each SM has space for 32 execution units. That means that for a single kernel invocation, I can have 1024 threads per block, okay. For the grid dimension, that's more or less arbitrary, okay.
One block is one warp.
the block specifies the threads. Okay. Your thread group. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the and each thread group, each block, has access to the same shared memory. Okay.
Yep.
That means that per warp, right? One warp has the ability to run 32 threads simultaneously, okay. Right? And I have 32 contexts, which I can store, right? That means that I'm able to run logically 1024 threads, which can access the same shared memory. Okay? Make sense? Yeah. Almost. So, and for the grid dimension, I can go arbitrarily high. Not arbitrarily, but significantly higher. So, it's going to take a while to execute all this, but hopefully it will give me the output. So let's revisit this and move on. Okay.
That's also not supercomputers.
Well, what did we learn last time? GPUs are good to run good code. This example code isn't very GPU friendly. So that's why it's taking so long. Also, we are executing
a huge amount of
stuff. There. Okay. Now my session got killed anyways.
No, but I think he will run it in the end.
Okay. Dum-da-dum-da-dum. So let me get another node. All right. So on the slides, there's the command on how you compile it, right? Mm-hmm. And then how it's being run. So this is just one example output, and it's just too long for the slide. So let's do something more interesting. Let's do this where I have my result vector, a vector A, a scalar X, and another vector B, right? So I do an element-wise multiplication of each element in vector B, and then an element-wise addition to the elements in vector A, and store it back to my result. Okay. Now, the programming model is that I write scalar code, right? So if I write my kernel, as the kernel arguments, I have a pointer to the A array, the scalar, the B array and the result array. I calculate the offset into my array depending on which block and which thread I'm in, right? I execute this whole group of threads. So I essentially linearize this my two-dimensional execution space, right? And then I so each kernel invocation, each thread is then executing this exact kernel, right? And that means that one thread is just doing this fairly simple calculation. Okay. So far, so good. Okay. So to start the kernel, we at the top here we declare our stuff. So our input array A and B, then our result array, then the pointer to the memory on the device. Okay, and then the size in bytes, okay, for the input arrays. The next line allocates the memory on the device, right? So I allocate space for 6 integers. Okay, I do this for my A, B, and the result, and then I copy the contents of A to the device, okay, and the contents of B also to the device, right? Okay. And once that's done, I just execute my my kernel, right? And here I'm executing I want to execute 6 threads, right? So 3 times 2.
Yeah, 6.
6. Okay, six because my because I have warp. 6 elements in my vector.
So 3, 6 threads in each warp.
No, 2 threads in a warp.
Okay.
So this example is not very utilizing the GPUs very well. Okay.
Because the good thing would be 1 and 6.
That would be better. Yeah, but I mean, this is a fairly small array. This is just for demonstration purposes.
Yeah. For me to understand how the thing of the warp to threads and block.
Yeah. So better would be in this example 1 and 6, because then you would execute 6 threads
in each warp.
And since we only have 6 elements, we only execute 1 warp, right? Okay, and once the kernel has been executed, we copy the memory back and synchronize and output the result. Okay.
With the synchronized part, why do we need a synchronized part?
The synchronized part is needed because all the operations here are asynchronous. Okay, they return immediately. Right?
So we synchronize the whole operation.
So they are The stream that I mentioned earlier, so the 0, is something like a queue where we enqueue the operations that we want the GPU to do, right? So malloc is not running asynchronously. It's just allocating something on the device and it gives us back the pointer, but the memcopy is just telling the device, hey, I want to copy, so please copy this data to the device and be done with it. If I want to wait on the copy to finish, right, I would need to put it asynchronous here, right? But other than that, I would just issue the copy command. Copy, so enqueue it, so they are still executed in order the way I enqueue them. So the next copy is only executed once the first has been finished, and the kernel is only executed once the second mem copy has been finished. Right?
In a normal way, without synchronizing.
Without synchronizing, because the operations are executed in order on the device. So in the same order we specified it here in our program. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah. But I want to wait on the last memcopy to finish. Right? That means I need to put a synchronize here. Right.
Okay. I think, yeah.
Okay. So, and that's working in the very same fashion. I need to swap my module. Okay, then I can, so the code is in here, right? So it's the very same code that I showed on the slides. And I can compile it. And then run it. And what I get back is that the that I have the first three elements changed. The other two aren't changed because the B vector is zero on the last three elements, right? So yeah. So here we have the zero, right? Oopsie. Right, here we have the zero. So that's why only the first three elements changed, right? So, and I of course can, so as you suggested, I can change this to 6 and 1, right? Let's time it. Probably won't notice anything anyway. So it's taking us 0.5 seconds, okay? Let's, and the result is still the same. Right, and if I switch it, that means I don't have any parallel. Well, I do have parallelization, but now you see it's taking slightly longer. Okay.
If it would 1 6.
It's almost insignificant. The overheads of the copy operation and the kernel start is too high. Right. Okay. So that's the basic gist of CUDA programming. So if I don't synchronize here, it's still working. Yeah. So I mean, it's still working, obviously, but it might not work eventually. But the printf is a fairly slow operation. Yeah. Anyways. That's it for today. Do you have questions? So now you are fit for programming GPUs. Mm-hmm. Now we made the full circle from basic computer architecture to GPU architectures. So now you are masters in vectorization, OpenMP programming, and now CUDA.
GPU. No. Go to NVIDIA. Let's go to NVIDIA.
Yeah.
Let's go to look at your NVIDIA.
Okay. So the next exercise will then be to adapt your stencil assignment to run on one GPU, right? You can of course try to optimize it as you wish, right? So there is a tool called NVPP, NVVP, NVIDIA Visual Profiler, where you can see what's going on the GPU. Okay. And yeah, you can try with different sizes, input sizes. You can try with different configurations for your grids and blocks, right? As you wish. And the assignment afterwards will then be to use two GPUs, okay? And once you know how to use two GPUs, we will make use of the EMI cluster and use multiple nodes. So you will extend your stencil example to run with MPI, with the message passing interface, which we will start covering next week. So next week we will dive into the networking stuff of the supercomputers.
Okay. And this assignment for next week?
What will get introduced next week, next Thursday or Friday, depending on when you go to the exercises.
So that's why I said we don't still need the data assignment will not be put it today.
No, next week. Next week. Yeah. No. Okay. Any questions? No?